This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after midday. And now, Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest this week is the Chief Rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks.
Jonathan Sacks has been Britain's chief rabbi for over 20 years. Among the many achievements of his distinguished tenure, he has worked tirelessly for the reinvigoration of Jewish music. I think you feel, Jonathan, that Jewish composers like Mahler and Mendelssohn wrote wonderful music for everyone else, but not specifically for Jewish people.
That's absolutely so. You know, Mahler's Eighth Symphony is a Catholic mass. Mendelssohn, whose grandfather was one of the great Jewish thinkers, already was born a Christian, and so there's very little identifiably Jewish in Mendelssohn, although the octet is perhaps the exception. And I just feel that whether you think of Irving Berlin writing White Christmas or George Gershwin writing Summertime, we've written all sorts of other music, but our own music we haven't really written.
I think you feel that there's a rather an identification with sad music when Jewish music is talked about, but and would like to see joyous music.
Well, you know, there's this Yiddish word, oi, which you say when you just reflect on the awfulness of the world, and my maxim has been less oi, more joy. I mean, you know, because Judaism is, deep down, a celebration of life. It's not a tragic faith.
Did you come to classical music through your family?
Well, yes. My late father was a very unusual person in a sense. He'd come over to Britain as a young man, as a refugee from Poland. He had to leave school at the age of 14 because the family couldn't afford to give him an education. He had to start earning for the family. And as a result, he spent his life as a small businessman in the East End of London in Commercial Road. But he had wonderful taste in literature, art, and music, and he was an amateur violinist. And he tried to sort of convey this to me, but being your usual teenager, I really wasn't interested in it. He kept thinking about this. He would play the fiddle, hoping it was very embarrassing, but it just didn't do anything for me. And finally, he hit on this wonderful idea, because they used to have regular concerts, for all I know, perhaps they still do, at the Albert Hall with Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture with full mortar effect. And I think he felt that all that noise and bangs and stinks and bangs sort of thing, this would speak to me. And the odd thing is, it did. It was just exciting. You know, you're sitting down there and all of a sudden the cannons start firing from near to heaven. And it was exciting. So I think he did succeed in persuading me to love classical music through Tchaikovsky's 1812.
Thank you.
still makes you want to get up and cheer, doesn't it?
And rather like a good comedian, Jonathan Sacks, he makes you wait for the punchline, doesn't he? Because he goes, ba-ba-da-da, 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 ba-ba-da-dee, ba-ba-da-da.
There was a Jewish comedian who was still alive, actually, called Jackie Mason, who in the 1960s used to begin his act by saying, "I may start slowly, but little by little, I die out completely." Which is exactly right for that particular bit of the 1812.
Part of Tchaikovsky's overture, played by the Gothenburg Symphony Orchestra with brass band and mortar, conducted by Neymar Yerevi. So in addition to introducing you to classical music, did your father push you in any direction academically?
No, actually, or in another sense, yes. And let me explain. One of the most burning memories from my childhood was asking my father all sorts of questions when I was 5, 6 years old. And he always used to give me the same answer. He always used to say, "Jonathan, I didn't have an education, so I can't answer your questions. But one day you will have the education that I didn't have, and when that happens, you will teach me the answers to those questions." Now, I don't think a parent could give a child a greater blessing than that, saying, "Become my teacher." So I became the first member of the family to go to university. And it was, I think, Dad and my mother as well, just made a lot of space for us and took a lot of pride. I mean, my father, when it got to university, did actually say to me, "Could it be Cambridge, not Oxford, because there's nowhere to park in Oxford?" But I did eventually get to Oxford, and now there's no place to park in Cambridge either. So, you know, we evened it up.
You read philosophy.
Yeah.
How did you move from there into becoming a rabbi?
Well, I went up to university in 66, 67. So towards the climax of the year, some very, very transformative event took place in the Middle East, which was the run-up the 3 weeks before the Six-Day War. Now, we look back and we see a dramatic and very rapid victory for the Israelis. But in the run-up to it, there was a real fear somehow that Israel would be obliterated, it would be driven into the sea. And those of us who had been born after the Holocaust suddenly woke up to the realization that, God forbid, maybe we were about to witness another Holocaust. Well, it didn't happen that way. But the feelings that it had unlocked in me were incredibly powerful. So the next summer, the summer of 1968, I felt I just had to explore at greater depth what it meant to be a Jew. And I traveled to America. I spent the whole summer there riding around on a Greyhound bus and meeting some of the greatest rabbis of our time. And that had a huge impact on me.
There was another meeting which had a huge impact on you.
Well, there was, actually. When I came back, I met a young lady. I invited her for dinner, and something happened on that occasion which never happened before and never happened since, which is I cooked a chicken. There used to be an old Yiddish saying, when a poor man eats a chicken, one of them is ill. So anyone who survived my chicken earned my love for life, and that young lady was Elaine, whom I married in 1970, and we've had 43 years of the most wonderful marriage. So for me, 68 was annus mirabilis, both in meeting Elaine and going to America. And that was all summed up by a song that came out in 1968, Simon and Garfunkel's incredibly atmospheric America, that recalled for me my travels on the Greyhound bus. But it was also that there had been a film with Simon and Garfunkel music called The Graduate, in which the heroine was called Elaine. So for me, America just sums up that most important year of my life.
Be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies and walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said, as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. Said, be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching and I don't know. And the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. All come to look for America.
One of the very few pop songs written in blank verse, and it's beautifully done.
Simon and Garfunkel's America from the 1968 album Bookends. It was also a time, wasn't it, of meeting Isaiah Berlin?
Yeah. Well, I was studying philosophy, and I met briefly Sir Isaiah Berlin in those days, but I got to know him much better towards the end of his life. And he was a very mischievous guy. The first time we sat together in our home, he said, "Chief Rabbi, whatever you do, don't talk to me about religion. When it comes to God, I'm tone deaf." And then he said, "What I don't understand about you is you're a philosopher. You studied at Oxford and Cambridge. How is it that you believe?" And I said, "Sir Isaiah, if it helps, think of me as a lapsed heretic." And he said, "Quite understand, dear boy, quite understand." Anyway, Isaiah was a terrific guy, and I officiated at his funeral in Oxford. And some months later, we did a memorial service for him in the Hampstead Synagogue, where he'd been a member. And as well as the many tributes, there was also some glorious music. Isaac Stern playing Bach, Alfred Brendel playing Schubert, and the cavatina from the Beethoven B-flat major quartet, which obviously Isaiah thought of as one of the most beautiful of all pieces of chamber music, as did I. But of course, much more importantly, so did Beethoven. I don't think music gets more spiritual than this.
There's a wonderful introduction to it, in a sense, isn't there, in a Rilke poem. I was wondering if you might like just to read those few lines.
Yeah, Rilke says in one of his elegies, "Words still go softly out towards the unsayable. And music always knew from palpitating stones builds in useless space its godly home." Thank you.
music from the Cavatina, from Beethoven's String Quartet No. 13 in B-flat major, Opus 130, played by the Takash Quartet. When you became a rabbi in 1978, where did you find your congregation, or where did they find you?
Well, it was in the ghetto, if you understand me. Golders Green, the epicentre of Jewish life. You know, I'd been feeling that I wanted to contribute somehow to the Jewish people, so I moved from philosophy to study for the rabbinate. And on the 1st of September, 78, I was inducted as the rabbi of the Golders Green Synagogue. 13 years later, to the day, on the 1st of September, 1991, I was inducted as chief rabbi. And 22 years after that, on the 1st of September this year, 2013, I will hand over to my successor. So there's a certain symmetry, closure there.
You've got some rather wonderful memories, and particularly your first visit to No. 10, I think, when John Major was Prime Minister.
Yes, we have an incandescent memory, because it was almost my most embarrassing moment, the first time that Elaine and I went for a meal at 10 Downing Street. The guest was the then President of the State of Israel, Chaim Herzog. It was a small lunch for about 20 people. There were members of the cabinet, the House of Lords, the President of Israel, some Israeli cabinet ministers, and I had been asked to say grace. And I thought we explained everything to the No. 10 staff, but actually there was one thing we hadn't explained, which was, in order to say grace in Judaism, you have to have some item of food to say it on. And there was actually no food on the table at all. And there was the Prime Minister of Britain and the President of Israel looking expectantly towards me. And I was caught with this dilemma. Do I make a blessing, which in Jewish law is a blessing in vain, taking the Lord's name in vain? Or do I disobey the Prime Minister and put an end to Anglo-Israel diplomacy? So, I was lifting up my eyes to the hills when my eye fastened on a thing that saved the day. It was a bunch of grapes that somebody had thought would look attractive draped around one of the gold table ornaments. So very, very quickly I said a blessing that included grapes and ate a grape, and honour was saved.
Was it at made end, of wax? It wasn't.
Yeah. No, it was a real grape, actually. It really was. I don't know what moved somebody to put this on, because it was clearly only there for decorative purposes. But at the end, I went up to the Prime Minister and said, Prime Minister, you must understand that your faith is different from ours. In fact, your faith is greater than ours, because you are prepared to thank the Lord for that which we are about to receive, whereas we, after long experience, prefer to have received it first.
And the actual day of your induction, I think, was memorable for good and rather uncomfortable reasons.
Well, there are two things I will never forget about it. First of all, it was, for me, just a moment to be able to say thank you to my parents. My father was in his 80s, had gone through some difficult operations, was just able to walk on crutches, but he was able to climb the steps and open the ark in the St. John's Wood Synagogue and see his son become chief rabbi, and that was very meaningful to me. The other thing was, I was wearing these very heavy robes. Believe it or not, the 1st of September 1991 was a heat wave, and there were also television lights because this whole ceremony was being televised, and I nearly fainted. I thought, what a way to begin. And then there wafted out the opening strains of the afternoon service, Psalm 145. Sung by a wonderful choir, the Shabbaton Choir, and an old friend of mine with whom I've worked to this day, Lionel Rosenfeld, a cantor, now a rabbi. And they had composed this new setting of Psalm 145, which we know in Judaism as Ashrei. And I thought to myself, what a beautiful piece. If the only thing I do as chief rabbi is to be able to say, I provoked that piece of music, I would say sufficient.
I think, Jonathan, you're being too modest, and that maybe both with the grapes and the arrival of the ashray, God was working his purpose out.
Yes, God has a sense of humour, and believe you me, he needs it the way we do.
Yeah.
Ashrei, performed by Lionel Rosenfeld and the Shabbaton Choir, and composed and arranged by Raymond Goldstein, Rabbi Lionel Rosenfeld, and Stephen Levy. It's about joy, isn't it, that piece?
It's about praising God and about celebrating his nearness. God is further away than the most distant star, but nearer to us than we are to ourselves. And I love the line that they were singing, which translates as God is close to all who call on him in truth.
It must help to have a good voice if you're chief rabbi.
No, you just lip sync a little bit, you know. I do love singing, and you know, I love the joy of Judaism, and that I think there's more than a little bit of Eastern Europe in my DNA, because my family came from Poland and Lithuania and Russia. And I always find that Jewish tendency of East European Jews to sing, to dance, to just celebrate is something I associate really with East European music, which is why I chose this wonderful opening of Stravinsky's Petrushka, which is just a shimmering wall of sound, and then, you know, the rhythm that just almost forces you to get up and dance.
A kind of wonderful, busy joyousness.
Yeah. To me, this is, I would play this at a Jewish wedding. That's, you know, that's the kind of celebration we have. And the better the rabbi, the more he has to sing and the more he has to dance. And this, for me, is the music of dance.
Thank you. Such a marvellous opening, that. The colours of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Wonderful. The opening of Stravinsky's Petrushka, the Shrovetide Fair. New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
Of course, Bernstein was such a multi-talented man and was a brilliant, brilliant conductor. And one of my most cherished memories, actually, is when I became the rabbi of the synagogue in Marble Arch, and it came to our holiest night, Kol Nidre night, on our Day of Atonement. And I'd just begun there, and somebody came over to me and said, "Oh, look, there's Leonard Bernstein there." And I assumed he was just joking. But lo and behold, there was Leonard Bernstein, who just happened to be in London and obviously went to the synagogue on this holy night. And I went over and I said hello to him. And at the end of the service, which was 2.5 hours later, he just stayed on. He wanted to meet our son, who was then 8 years old, who was sitting with me in the synagogue. And he stopped and spent 20 minutes talking to this young boy, telling him about music and the music he was writing at the time, which was, I think, something to do with the Holocaust. And so I have incredibly warm memories of Leonard Bernstein.
Do you find, and maybe this is a slightly naive question, but as with so many Jews in this century and the last, and certainly with Leni Bernstein, an incredible weight lies on you because of the tragedies that happened?
I do think so. I think, the more I've studied the Holocaust and that essentially extinction of so many Jewish communities, the less I find I understand it. And, of course, that brings me to the next selection, which was Gustav Mahler. I mean, Mahler was a very Jewish composer, but in Vienna, which was a very Jewish city. I mean, you had Mahler there, you had Sigmund Freud there, virtually all the psychoanalysts there. You had Karl Kraus, the brilliant, brilliant writer. It was a collection of talent the like of which one hadn't seen in any European capital. But the anti-Semitism at the same time was there. Karl Luger, the mayor of Vienna, was a very public anti-Semite. And such was the hostility in Vienna to Jews and Judaism that Gustav Mahler had to convert to Christianity in order to be able to conduct the Vienna Court Opera. And I sense all sorts of intuitions and intimations in Mahler's music. It's very Viennese, but there's always a macabre note to the waltz-like movements that he writes. And then he has a series of pieces in the Fourth Symphony, the Ninth, Das Lied von der Erde, and elsewhere, which is so unbearably sad and so heavy with death that you kind of feel he had some presentiment of what might be coming. Rather like Franz Kafka did in Prague, there's a kind of horrific feel of a great tragedy in the making. And I feel this particular passage from the slow movement of the Fourth Symphony is almost an elegy written in advance for the extinguished Jewish communities of Europe, and in particular of Vienna.
part of the third movement of Mahler's Fourth Symphony, played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Daniele Gatti. Of course, Mahler's music was used famously in Death in Venice, and in fact it is film music, Thomas Newman, that you have chosen next.
Well, I think film music, you know, is all about, less about structure than about mood, and I'm very interested in mood, so I have an annoying habit of really leaning into film music. I know it should be sort of almost subliminal. And I certainly find among all the great composers of film music, Thomas Newman is the most mystical and metaphysical. And so I fell in love with the film The Shawshank Redemption, which is really a film about hope. And the fact that this wonderful story about hope came together with Thomas Newman, I think of The Shawshank Redemption as the music of hope. And here is music at a sad moment of the film, but on the borderline between hopelessness and hope.
Thank you.
It's a great example of simplicity, less is more, really working, isn't it? Because it just held strings, basically, and then that repeated very simple but touching pattern on the piano.
It needs that kind of genius to be that simple and that economical, and I find Thomas Newman's music outstanding in that way.
Brooks was here from Thomas Newman's soundtrack for the film The Shawshank Redemption. Jonathan Sachs, you said that the languages of religion are particular, but there's something universal about the human spirit that transcends our differences, which is a lovely thought, but you must sometimes find it hard to hold on to, given what is happening in the world, and particularly in the Middle East.
Oh, well, absolutely. I think religion has been a great source of conflict in human history. I think Jonathan Swift once said, "We have just enough religion to make us hate one another and not enough to make us love one another." And you sometimes find ages, you know, where religion speaks not to the better angels of our nature. And that is why I really feel that music is one of the things that does lift us, rather like food. If I wanted to bring religious peace to the world, I would ignore everything except food and music. And eating together and singing together, somehow we would move way beyond the small things that become such big things that divide us.
Well, the East-West Divan Orchestra was a wonderful example of that.
Yeah, I think using music as a way of bridging partners in a conflict is just a wonderful thing. An inspired way, which I think is part of the nature of music. You know, that is music. It is taking many voices or many instruments and somehow making them sing.
Well, that's a wonderful description of your final piece of music.
Yeah. This particular piece of music is, of course, from one of the greatest of all church composers, Johann Sebastian Bach, the Double Concerto. And this is, you know, music that comes deep from Christian Europe, but played by two Jewish violinists, Isaac Stern and Yitzchak Perlman. Now, Yitzchak Perlman, of course, contracted polio at a young age and plays in a wheelchair. And I once heard a story, it must be totally apocryphal, about his playing a violin concerto when in the first movement a string snapped and he proceeded rather heroically to play the rest of the concerto on three strings. And the story goes that he was given a huge standing ovation at the end and everyone wanted him to say a few words. And he came on stage and he said, referring not only to literally to what had just happened, but to what he was as a person and maybe what we all are as human beings. He said, "It's our task to make music with what remains." Now, I asked Yitzchak Perlman when I met him, "Is that story true?" And he gave me a big smile and said, "No. But never mind. I love it. It's a great story. And for me, that is the place of music in the human condition, to let us joyously sing in the midst of great difficulties and tensions and injustices, but somehow let the human spirit sing."
Thank you. The first movement of Bach's double violin concerto in D minor, played by Itzhak Perlman and Isaac Stern, with the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Zubin Mehta. So, as your tenure as chief rabbi comes to a close, I wonder what you feel summarizes it. Certainly, if I might say, you have been a wonderful spokesman for thinking generously.
Well, I think we've been through a period of immense renaissance in the British Jewish community. We've built a lot of Jewish schools. We have a better Jewishly educated young generation. We've been very culturally creative as well. And it's just been a privilege to work with a community of very, very creative individuals. And I hope in a little way we've also brought a little new Jewish music into the repertoire. And one way or another, you know, I just feel that the community sings a little more joyously than it used to do. And I'm just standing there at the back of the choir, just carried along by the words and the music.
So much music and much food to look forward to.
Well, I hope so. Music to me is like oxygen. It's oxygen for the soul. I think wherever I go and whatever I do, I will try and make it musical, literally or figuratively. And so I'm looking forward to the next great stage on the long, long journey.
Jonathan Sachs, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Barclay was talking to Lord Sachs. The producer was Olivia Seligman, and the programme was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And there's now a weekly download of the series available. Visit the Private Passions page on the Radio 3 website for details. Next week, Michael Barclay's guest is the children's writer Judith Carr.